Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk.
Crazy weather we're having.
No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I am Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And we're coming to you live from a couple places on the internet. We're live on Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, Instagram, Twitch. Not Kick tonight, sadly. We got kicked from Kick. Unfortunately, the spam bots.
That's a tough way to start,
bro. What a stormy relationship.
I know.
I do have a question. Alex, you've started to introduce yourself on all of our podcasts as I am Alex. It's a more powerful stance. You used to do I'm Alex. Now you're coming out with I am. It's like I am She-Ra.
He just saw I Am Legend. He's really into it.
Yeah, that movie's great. Have you checked it out? My favorite line in I Am Legend was he's like, I am legend.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I picked that up and I kind of ran with it.
I like I Robot. Similar idea. I want to say I Justin.
Yes. My favorite part of iRobot is when they... never mind. I couldn't figure out.
Wow. Can't remember anything about that movie? Yeah, so you sound like...
When he talks to mannequins in the VHS store?
Alan Tiddick was the robot in that.
Yes,
it was his first robot role of many robot roles leading up to his robot role in Superman this summer. So there you go.
That guy's fake. He's AI.
Probably.
What?
Why is he being so many robots, huh?
I don't know.
Because he has a robot voice?
No, he has a regular voice.
Well, anyway, maybe you're listening wherever you get your podcasts. I am Alex, just in case you don't know.
I just...
Doubling down? Can we move
and
past
And if you
this?
Want ad-free versions of this podcast and all the podcasts, we do patreon.com/comicbookclub. But business out of the way, let's get Thank to pleasure, God. Which is talking to our amazing guests that we have this evening. We have two of them for you. We're going to bring in the first one. He's the creator of To the Stars and Back, which is a huge hit on Webtoon, and now Volume 1 is out now from Little Brown Ink. Ladies and gentlemen, Peglo, welcome.
Hey, welcome.
Hello.
Thank you so much for having me. This is
oh my
awesome.
Gosh. Excited to have you here. Excited to talk about this book. So this has been running for 208 episodes on Webtoon.
Wow.
It wrapped up, if I remember correctly, last year. And now you have Volume 1 is out now. Came out a couple of weeks ago. Volume 2 coming out on May 26, 2026. And to lay in a little bit of the plot here.
Yeah, lay it in.
It's not, while I was reading it, the phrase that kept going through my head, so it was like, it's not exactly enemies to lover, but that's kind of the setup a little bit. You basically have like two people who live in apartments next to each other. One of them is very persnickety. The other one is not. And slowly they come together without spoiling too much in a romantic relationship. This is going back, obviously, 208 episodes. But what was the initial inspiration behind the story?
Honestly, this is like one of the only stories where it started out as just kind of playing around with it. It started on my Instagram. I was kind of going through an art rut at that moment. I was like a massive burnout with everything to do with like art and stories and everything. And I was like, okay, well, if anything that I've learned is that to get out of an art rut is to do something that you're not really used to and to kind of explore that. So my style and my storytelling was usually very big and expressive and like very like I had more of a detailed art style. So I was like, okay, let's play around with like a simple art style and a simple sort of story. And I didn't really plan it at that point. And so when I showed my audience on Instagram, because it was just casual. I wasn't expecting it to be anything. People really liked it and people really had a positive reception to it. And yeah. I found out that I really liked it too. So I was just like, okay, let's do that. And then from there, I kind of pulled from like a lot of the slice of life sort of animes that I liked that had more of a slow, gradual growth through the characters and through the story, kind of like more low key, nothing really too overwhelming because I didn't really want to make it dramatic. I was trying to do something different. You know, usually in my story, somebody always ends up dead. So I decided not to do that.
Good for you.
Yeah, it just turned into something so much bigger than I thought it would, which is awesome.
Yeah, congratulations. Now, I was wondering, do you have someone in your life is a little bit of a curmudgeon that maybe inspired this, or am I reading into that too much?
Or are you the curmudgeon?
Yeah, ooh, that's a good question. Thank you.
Honestly, yeah. Both of these characters are kind of parts of myself. So I kind of see them as like two halves of myself, and they kind of come together. However, Bo-san is over time kind of, I pulled inspiration from my own partner. So a lot of like the language that you see, like a lot of the conversations that they have, especially like the emotional moments,
yeah,
I actually pulled from my conversations with my partner.
Oh, wow.
A lot of nice. Came from us having those conversations.
Well, that's well. That makes it kind of a beautiful love letter to you and your partner almost.
Yeah. Now,
does that make it easier to do like the slow burn of it? I would feel like that would be hard to modulate, to really let it cook. But I guess if you're drawing right from your life, does that help?
Honestly, I've always loved slow burn to like watch and to read. I've never actually tried it myself. I usually just jump right into the action.
Yeah, so, I live my life at 100 miles an hour as well. So
I mean, love a slow burn. I have ADHD, so everything's fast. So what happened with this was I really had to pull back with this. I had to not jump right into drama and action. I had to really kind of center myself in a weird way to just pull back and allow things to kind of drip feed in the story, which was a really good skill for me to learn because it taught me restraint. It taught me how to pace things a lot better and to kind of let the moments sit in itself. And I've carried that over into my next project as well. And it's taught me a lot. So while it was painful to be like, oh my God, okay, just fucking get to it already. It was actually really nice to just kind of learn a new skill.
I'm sure you're tired of these comparisons by this point, but certainly while reading this, I thought a little bit about Heartstopper, not just because of the webtoon of it all, not just because of the queer of it all, but also because, like you were kind of touching on earlier, these are both very gentler romances that don't necessarily shy away from some harder topics at the same time. I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but why do you think audiences are responding or are so hungry for that particular type of storytelling in particular?
Probably because it's easy. Well, there's a couple of different reasons. I think for one, it's easier to digest. So instead of, let's just say that you've had like a full day at work or you've had a full day out and then you come home and then you kind of want to read something. I think sometimes reading something that's like really big and dramatic can sometimes tire you out as well. So just to kind of sit down and read something that's easy to digest, something kind of heartwarming, something easy to kind of look at is quite comforting after that sort of long day or if you've had a rough time. And then also with that, interwoven with topics that maybe people relate to, whether that be like bullying or trauma or anything like that, kind of woven into a story that's not too heavy on it. It kind of touches on it, but it doesn't feel like, oh my goodness, I'm having flashbacks to that time, because I don't like that either. I don't like reading something and then just being jump scared with something that reminds me of my past. So I wanted to be really careful with this, but I think that that's kind of what people like about these sorts of stories. At least that's what my audience has been kind of telling me, is that they enjoy that it's something that they can just sit down and read. And then especially because it's kind of more of a short form. Obviously, the book is quite thick, but when I was on Webtoon, the episodes were quite short. Mm-hmm. So people could just kind of binge read it, or they could just read a quick episode and it gave them a bit of a pick-me-up. And so I think that's kind of why, in my personal opinion.
That's awesome.
I wanted to ask you, sorry, just something more about that, because we talk about this every time we have a Webtoon creator on. You knew I was going to go into this.
I was going to ask the same thing.
Oh, okay. Well, specifically about the length of the strips, I thought was really interesting, because we focus more on mainstream comics. So definitely, as we've been getting more into Webtoon, we've seen how people handle the vertical format in different ways. And I thought it was really fascinating that you did it. It's a little longer, this, but it's almost like comic strip style. Like, it's a sort of like a quick hit. So I think you kind of answered this, but like, why was that important for you? And was there any temptation as you continued to go longer?
Oh, there was definitely a temptation. Definitely in season two and volume two, as the story got a little bit more, like, we got into the characters. And I think the second volume, it has a little bit more emotion in it. It was very tempting to make the episodes longer. And a couple of times I did make the episodes longer, but it also uploaded twice a week. So it was like a twice a week sort of little bit of story. And I think it helped because it was a slice of life. Usually with Webtoons, they're quite long. So the episodes usually run for about 40 to 60 panels, whereas for Slice of Life, they usually upload maybe twice or even three times a week, and they usually run from anywhere between 10 to 20 panels. So it's supposed to be kind of consumed in a smaller sort of bite-sized piece, I reckon.
You talk about a lot of, like Alex is saying, a lot of the Webtoon folks we have on here talk about it being an arduous process, the translation. And it sounds like it was less so for you, but having it's in book form, does that make you, does it make you want to go back to the Webtoon format or try something further in the more classic paper comic?
I like both, honestly. I am doing another Webtoon, so that comes out next month, actually.
Nice.
And I do enjoy the Webtoon format. It's very different than like traditional comics. But I kind of like both for different reasons as well. I enjoy Webtoons because it is the scroll format, but with it, the panels are kind of crafted to feel like it's flowing and moving on its own as you scroll down. And to me, that was kind of fascinating. I always loved that kind of feel when I first saw it a couple of years ago. And I was like, oh, I want to try that. But I have always been, because I've been making comics not very good ever since I was a kid. And I used to make them in like the traditional format. So going over to Webtoon, I had no idea what I was doing. I was just trying to see what everybody else was doing, because you mentioned that it felt like a comic strip, like the traditional sort of. That's because I didn't really know how to make a Webtoon. And so I was just like, okay, how can I reformat this in a way that I'm used to? I've obviously gotten more used to it now as the story went, I got more into the Webtoon scroll format. But I am somewhere deep inside, I am still used to the old format. So
it's so interesting you say that. I feel like a lot of the like wildly successful Webtoon people are like, I don't know what I was doing. And suddenly there's a huge audience that is there for that. Like, do you feel like there's a sort of a rawness, like a realness, authenticity that you hit because you don't know exactly what you're doing? Or there's no real reason for this, but this is a pattern that I think we've observed.
Probably, honestly. Maybe just the vulnerability of not knowing what you're doing. But also, like, kind of seeing, I think a lot of people see webtoon authors as like just ordinary people a lot of time, because there's not that barrier between, I mean, don't get me wrong, it can get very parasocial and it can get annoying. But I think when people see webtoon creators, they see the whole process, they see how they think and how they draw and see work in progress and everything like that. So I think with that, it feels like maybe we're more like approachable, more human. I don't know. I always felt like, oh, if I ever met somebody that did like a comic book that I read, I would feel very intimidated because I'd be like, oh my goodness, you're like amazing. I see you everywhere and that sort of thing. Whereas I feel like with webtoon creators, maybe it feels a little bit more like casual. I'm not sure. It's definitely not casual. This job is really, really difficult. I'm constantly stressed, but
yeah, it's like oppressed. The schedule has to, the schedule has to feel oppressive, like you're saying.
Twice a week.
The schedule is, definitely towards the end, in when I was doing the second season, I was running on fumes. And when I finished, I like passed out. Like when the whole comic was finished, I passed out because I was just like, was a lot. I was so stressed. And like, I do like the weekly deadlines because of my ADHD, because if I don't have the weekly deadlines, then I leave everything way too last minute. So I do like it. But at the same time, I'm still getting used to it because it's very, very stressful to do like every week at a high quality. And because you get really picky about what you make because you want it to look a certain way and you want it to look really good. But you know that with such a strict deadline, you can't. So you have to kill some of your darlings. You've got to like, okay, move on. I have literally a sticky note on my computer monitor saying, it's good enough, move on. Because that was keep thinking.
Sorry. And right underneath that, it said, pass out when you finish. Right?
Oh, yeah, it's right under there as well. I can see it.
I imagine you fainting like an old school community theater play.
Like, oh, yeah, absolutely. Just right onto the bed, too.
I did want to ask you something off of the authenticity thing. This is not to make you sell out your platform or anything like that, but there has been an influx of bigger publishers onto Webtoon. Like, as a very specific example, when I went there today to take a look at your comic, I just plugged in like, oh, let me just look for To the Stars and Back. And immediately Star Wars came up from the Marvel comics. And I was like, no, not that. That's not what I want. Until I finally got to your thing. Well, what is your feeling on that? Because that is adding something new and different to the platform versus what you're talking about. A person was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm putting it up here and built a community around that.
Oh, so like the what's the question?
Marvel.
Like
how do you feel about Marvel? The Webtoon. I mean, there's other publishers.
Wow. But
I didn't really see that coming, to be honest. I mean, I don't think anybody really did. I think it's interesting. I do like that it is separated into a separate genre. I think it's under like graphic novel. So we're still kind of separated, so we can still kind of get our growth normally from that sort of spotlight, like separated, so we're not integrated too much. But I'm not entirely sure. Like, I think it's interesting. I don't usually read a lot of Marvel or Star Wars or anything like that. I am more on the side of like anime and manga. So, but I guess it could be good to bring people onto Webtoon. Like, if you're interested in those sort of classic comics and brought to more of a webtoon scroll format, maybe you'll find some other ones done by actual, like, webtoon creators that you might like. You know, bringing more people onto the platform, and maybe people who usually read webtoons can read the other stuff as well that they've brought on. I mean, I think it could be good. I didn't see it coming, but maybe there is something good with it.
Well, I definitely like your positive outlook on it, and I do hope that it brings people to it. No, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to belabor it too much, but I was surprised since I have not been on Webtoon in a little bit. I clicked in. First thing, there was a full page before I could even get to the app an ad for Beauty of the Beast comics that they were doing.
I saw that one. Yeah.
Then there was a banner right at the top for the Marvel stuff. And then, like I said, I just wanted to find your comic. But yeah. I had to type in basically the whole name before I could get past Star Wars and have it pop up. So
yeah,
maybe some kinks to work out there.
I guess the hardest part is, at least for me, is like, how much, the question is like, how much do we have to kind of go against them, because they're already established titles, and for somebody that's kind of indie or just starting out, maybe it could be a little bit rough. I could see that, right. And it could be maybe a little bit disheartening for people who are aiming to become like a Webtoon original or even just to publish on Canvas. I can kind of see that, but I'm hoping that's not the case. I'm hoping that things turn out okay.
Well, it's a struggle for me in my comic, The Empire Strikes Backwards. Yeah. I just feel like I keep getting, no one can find me.
Oh, really? Well, that's, yeah. The search function is great title. The greatest. Not gonna
Thank you.
So this book is great, but like you were saying, you have another one that is coming out to Webtoon soon. What can you tease about that?
Okay, so that one is coming out the 24th of next month. And it's basically another BL sort of boys love romance, queer romance as well. But this time it's like a supernatural sort of, it's got a little bit of like magic elements. I'm trying to dive a little bit more into like spooky elements as well, like a little bit of horror, a little bit of thriller. So it's quite different to The Stars and Back. This one's like more of light and fluffy and very simple sort of storytelling, nothing too crazy. Whereas this one is crazy. This one is, there's a lot happening. Literally in the first few episodes, there's lots happening, and it's been really fun, but the episodes are a lot longer and I am feeling it very intensely.
Well, hang in there, man. Don't pass out.
Burn, it sounds like. Yeah, don't pass out yet.
No, not yet. I have to finish the season first.
Oh, okay.
Well, the book is great. Congratulations. Yeah, congrats. I'm very excited to read volume 2 as well next year, and can't wait to check out the new one. Thank you so
Thank
much
you
for
so
coming
much.
On.
Thank so you excited. For having me.
Great work.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
All right. There we go. The book is once again called To the Stars and Back. Volume 1 is out now from Little Brown Ink. Check it out in stores everywhere. And volume 2, as I mentioned, is coming out May 26th. 2026. You can check it out then. Also, if you have Webtoon, you can check out 208 episodes there. And that's
right there.
Cool.
It's right there.
It's alive.
Baby. Binge it.
And yeah, check out the new one as well.
You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Oh, we have another guest on this evening, and I'm very excited to talk to him about his awesome book. It's called Black Arms to Hold You Up. It's on sale now for Pantheon. Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Passmore. Ben,
welcome
to the show.
What's up?
Hello. You're on mute, Ben. Oh, there we go.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. Very excited to talk about this book. Like I said, this is out in Pantheon. And just to give folks like a broad overview, correct anything that I got wrong, but the idea of the book is there's a pseudo stand-in for you who encounters some real-life historical things that are going on and proceeds to go through several different iterations of history as you're sucked through seeing Black activists throughout time. And it gets deeper and more intricate as it goes. There's some gorgeous art throughout, but I'm giving, again, like, the absolute broadest overview there. So I'd love to hear from you what your pitch is for the book, like how you talk to people about it.
This is pretty good.
Sounds like maybe it wasn't, but I appreciate it. Well,
he's gonna face about to fix it for
you.
I lived the book for 5 years, so obviously I'm gonna be overly opinionated about it. So I'm trying to hold that in all conversations.
You can yell. But, you can yell if you want.
not in this economy. It's the book. I'd sort of jokingly say it's a mix of the Black Power mixtapes and the what is it, Miss Frizzle?
Magic School Bus.
That's I grew up on that. But so it's a bit of mix of that. My I make it a little bit amorphous, but essentially after the murder of Philando Castile, which is in 2016. By a police. There was a lot of uprisings, similar to, you know, after George Floyd was murdered. So I make the sort of starting point a little amorphous, but more or less my dad shows up in the midst of a bit of an uprising, and he finds me just sort of in my house, more or less disinterested, and sort of to get me on the right path and also to establish a bit of a better relationship with me. He drags me through about 100 years of Black radical history. The focus is not so much on activists, although there are people involved who people will call an activist, people who are sort of trying to maneuver the government in different ways. But the emphasis was on revolutionaries and a lot of people who fought back. So we have Robert F. Williams in there, who wrote Negroes with Guns. He's sort of the bit of the grandfather of the Black Panther Party. They started his writings, and he briefly was the president of the Republic of New Africa, which was an independence organization that was formed after Malcolm X was assassinated. But we also, the book begins with Robert Charles, who was just a day laborer, essentially, and someone who passed out literature about immigrating back to Africa. That was a bit of a movement at the side. At the time, immigration societies, and it's sort of a very modern story. He's out with his roommate waiting for his girlfriend to meet up with him, and the police decide he's not supposed to be in that neighborhood. And it's a story we see all the time. But what is different is that when the police tried to shoot him, he got them first. And that sort of jumps into a 2 day battle with like 10,000 police officers and soldiers and farmers. So that all sounds very serious, but it is also a pretty funny book too.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, like how you struck the tone. Cause I think the balance between not only the serious, situations and issues you're talking about, but sort of some, like big history you're dropping here and like having a lot of fun. Like what was that hard to modulate?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. Well, for me, I have a tendency to be too jokey too often. My earlier career was my beat was grassroots movements. I got politicized during the anti-fascist movement that is, you know, being criminalized now, more or less. And a lot that involved a lot of pretty terrifying things on the street. And I just habitually will crack jokes in the middle of being tear gassed and stuff. The bigger struggle was to let the more sort of serious dramatic moments drag out. I think, you know, many of us would rather not sit in those moments because they're very painful. But I think, you know, for me, the comedy is, you know, there's a couple voices in my head. There's older people who are like, don't be disrespectful. So there's that. There's also it functions to sort of add information. Like, for instance, Ron Karanga, who's, among other things, the inventor of Kwanzaa, briefly appears in the book. Ron Karanga did some pretty terrible stuff. I have a choice to go into it because it involves kidnapping, or I can just have my character react in sort of horror as someone tells me about it. And I'm like the Kwanzaa guy. You know, so in that way, it creates an easy shorthand to sort of get out information.
Well, yeah, I just want to say, first off, like, this is great. You know, this had to be hard to make. It's beautiful. I laughed. I cried. How does it feel to, you know, be putting something like this out there. They'd be trying to make a difference instead of just accepting the status quo, to be kind of putting self out there that kind of educates and hopefully helps.
Well, I mean, fortunate for me, you know, and sort of what is fortunate for me is that I come from a political tradition that expects to be, you know, are the things we have to say and what we want to do and how we want to live is like pretty unwelcome. And I, in fact, drew from a lot of writers, both academic and non, that are the ones that really made sure that we knew what was happening. Like it, in the beginning with Robert F. Charles, one of the only people, or really the only person that, that wrote about him in a clear-eyed way was Ida B. Wells, who was a Black journalist at the time in Boston. Yeah. And no one else was interested, you know. So in that way, it's it feels a bit at home and you know, the right time, because, you know, it's kind of unfortunately all the right time. I think in some ways I was worried, you know, because I started this, I sold the book to Pantheon in 2020, and that's when I started production.
Oh, wow.
So it's 5 years, you know, and I was a bit worried that a book that was, you know, written in a lot of ways during the optimism of 2020, you know what I mean, when it seemed like, okay, you know, like this is a really big push, we might actually see a slightly different world. And what we're seeing is at least dominating, in my view, in the government is the backlash to it. So in some ways I was like, it, I feel like the book is fairly optimistic. But I think, you know, now that it's out there and people reading it, I feel like people are seeing the value in it. I think one of the big things that I came away with after researching a lot for the book and writing it is just how, like how we think about fascism in America has often been pretty limited to self-described fascists. But many of us know that, you know, the Nazis that we know were inspired by a lot of things that our government did. And when you think about their tradition, you know, the Panthers, a lot of the people in the Black Liberation Movement, they're anti-fascist. They're fighting a lot of the systems and beliefs, right, that operated, you know, in Europe, and the people that we call fascists. So I think in that way, it is really right on time. You know what I mean? Because these people are sort of fighting. This basically starts during the Reconstruction, and Reconstruction is when a lot of this evil started, you know what I mean, in this particular way. So in that way, it's like, it feels right on time.
Well, and on the timeliness thing, one of my big takeaways from this was, at a time when stories like this are literally being erased from books, like to have, I don't want to spoil it, but some moments at the end are about literally putting stories into people's heads. Yeah. Like I was like, oh, this is actually really, like, powerful. I can't believe how in the moment it is.
Yeah.
And in that way, I'm benefiting from the cyclical nature of repression.
Nice. How'd you see it coming?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. One thing too, I really wanted to push, because in the production of this, I think I really came to understand and respect how hard being a historian is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Both trained and untrained. And I really started to ask myself, what can I bring to this as not a historian, but a cartoonist, you know? And one of the things that comics does really well is perspective, you know what I mean? So this book is a history book, but I also wanted people to be self-reflective of this desire to seek one truth, like media analysis of information, study, research. These are skills that everyday people can have that are just sort of falling away. Like in my own family, I'll have an argument with one of my family members and they'll be like, oh, I'm researching something. I'm like, all right, go ahead and send it to me. It's one picture with circles on it. You know what I mean? And I'm like, that's not research. You know what I mean? That's barely a meme, you know?
Yeah.
So I
put in 15 to 16 seconds on this. What are you talking about?
Right, yeah.
I started with my finger circles. 16.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No. Please, you are the guest. Finish your point.
Okay. Well, as the guest, I'll take up this space. The end of the thought was just that in the book, there's a bit of a twist that makes you second guess how you've received the information. And I thought that felt important for me. both to just be like, study is really, really important. And you shouldn't just read one thing with this assumption that you got it. You have to read a lot of different things, even if it's, especially if it's something that you're reading that you really agree with. You're like, okay, well, like, let me read something else to make sure I got the other angle.
Well, and I love that approach. I mean, we're talking about this anyway, but the big takeaway for the book is like, hey, take more takeaways after the end of this, that it's not necessarily like, and I've reached a conclusion about how to solve this problem that we're facing. It's more, this is a problem. It's ongoing. There's different ways to approach it. Here are several different ways people approached it throughout history with different challenges they came upon. Now you go. Now you do your thing. And I love that. Like, I really love that approach that you're talking about. I did want to ask you, though, about the art style, which we haven't talked about yet, which I loved as well.
Yeah, great use of red.
Well, that was the first thing I wanted to ask you about, is you limit the colors to black, white, grays, obviously, and pink. So what was the choice there?
Yeah, I would say it's a coral red.
Oh, excuse me.
But yeah, it is a bit of a pink. Well, I think, you know, and the unartistic, right, you know, consideration always is what is the publisher interested in printing, right? And in a lot of ways, for the big book publishers, I think what they would prefer is to do black and white. I don't really like doing that. I did a book called Sports as Hell a couple of years ago that was like black, white, and orange. And I like the challenge of picking a color that had a bit of flexibility, more or less, like in terms of what it can represent, just in terms of temperature. You know, the reddish pink is very energetic in a lot of ways. Right. You know what I mean? So it felt a little bit like something that I would have to tame, but also could really help me to sort of like draw, you know what I mean? Draw the eye across the page. There's a lot of 200 pages is like a lot of pages, but kind of not a lot for 100 years of history. Right. So I'm changing like where we're at, like kind of, you know, within a page sometimes. So I wanted to sort of change tones really quickly if I needed to. And the red was really useful for that.
This is a hyper-specific question, but in response to your hyper-specific color choice, when did you land on that? Like, at what point in the process were you like, had you already had the story? Like, when does the color actually enter the storyteller brain?
The color was really early on. And I mean, in part, I was like, unsurprisingly, when I was trying to think of like a visual approach to this, I was like, well, let me start with Emery Douglas, you know, the infamous, what would we say, art director of the Panther newspaper, but also the main illustrator. And because of the limitations of the newspaper, obviously, he is doing black in one color. And also, you know, there's the classic, you know, sort of like Maoist, like bright reds and stuff, even though, like, you know, I don't come from it. I'm not writing the Maoist tradition. I did think about, like, what are easy entries to what is ultimately sort of complicated information? I'm featuring people that in some cases had like very different political positions. In a lot of ways, like people really want to read about the Panthers and they're like, you're giving me all these names. That's a bit of a snooze fest. So I thought, you know, a black and red scheme, you know what I mean, would be this really good shorthand in the early pages. You know what I mean? We're like, oh, we're reading something political, black and red. So it feels political.
Yeah. You also, as part of the art, and often these things are in the coral red, as we've decided, the sound effects, you deploy those pretty liberally throughout the book and use some very creative ones throughout. There are often pages where they almost take over the entire page. So kind of pivoting off of what Justin was saying earlier, how do you modulate that? How do you make sure that you're using the sound effects the right way at the right time?
Well, for the big ones, you'll notice there's a lot of crowd scenes. So the best thing for a crowd scene are huge blocks of letters, obviously, so you don't have to draw it all. But I think in general, I wanted a very loud and kinetic book, you know? I wanted to take like really big swings. You know, narcissistically, as an artist, this is my answer. I wanted to take a lot of big swings. Sort of similarly, I changed styles when the point of view changes in a couple parts of the book. I had never done that before. But in general, yeah, I just wanted a book that felt really, really kinetic, really cartoony too. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of times there will be books in this sort of genre and they're like really austere. They're really serious because the topics are really, really serious. But like, I guess grandiosity felt like a bit of a cage for me because I was going to have to jump around. I was going to have to cover a lot of heavy topics with like no time. Like there's two women in the Robert F. Williams chapter who were in court being scrutinized because they've been assaulted by white men. I have basically two pages to feature their point of view. It's an impossible, you know what I mean? Yeah. That's a disrespectful short amount of space. So I think a lot of the sound effects, a lot of these approaches had to do with just trying to like keep the kineticism going so we don't, you know what I mean? So that the speed doesn't feel disrespectful.
Well, and I think that is how you're saying this anyway, but like, that's how you draw people in, right? Like we all have comedy backgrounds and we've certainly all done like political comedy stuff. And I've always found when you tell somebody a political idea, they either agree with it or don't. But if you're doing it as part of a comedy show, they're laughing. That's an agreement in a certain way. So they're not
understanding at the very least.
Exactly. Like they may not 100% come over your side, but they're going to be more amenable to what you're hearing.
It's awesome to hear you kind of talk about it. I'm wondering, because it is so intricate and there's so much going on, did you have to like map everything out and be like, okay, I'm going to put like a joke here because this is some crazy shit. And then I want to kind of do the prison with the cells and all that here. Like it's some amazing, not only artistry, but also some storytelling that is magnificent. And even the kind of pace and the tone shifts and everything. It's really quite an achievement. Like, did you kind of have to kind of put it all on a board first as it was in your brain or how did you kind of translate that?
Yeah. And I appreciate that. It's, I did have to do, like some meta mapping just in terms of like the rise and the fall. Fortunately, when I was sort of selecting who I was writing about, that was a bit embedded. I begin with what uncharitably could be called a mass shooter, and I end with a mass shooter. And in a lot of ways, they're in terms of their relationship with their community, the lack thereof, that is the same. And then within that, I wanted to answer the question, well, how did that happen? How do we end up where we started? And that comes from sort of the rising up of a certain movement through Garvey and Black Power and New African nationalism, and then sort of descends as the Panthers are repressed and there's the Move chapter where they're bombed. It goes through like the crack years and the Crips coming up, you know, because there's no elders. So in that way, right, there's already this fall. And then within each chapter, I tried to sort of replicate that too with a bit of a rising and falling. So yeah, I mean, the short answer is I 100% got a bunch of sticky notes and wrote a buckload and put it up on my wall. Absolutely. And that looks super crazy. I even sent a picture to my girlfriend to be like, this is where I'm at right now.
Don't come over.
Yeah, my brain.
This is why I haven't
right
called
now.
You back. Yeah.
Right.
Oh my God.
We got a couple of questions here over in the comments. Derek Mainhart says, are there other comic creators addressing similar issues that you'd recommend? And I will note you have a recommended reading list in the back, but I don't know if those were specifically comics, I don't think.
Yeah, there's no comics in the back, which I know is mean to do. but yeah, there's no...
There's, can't even recommend like a Spider-Man or something like that? Like,
right,
come on.
Yeah. At least Miles Morales. So something I'm reading right now is Gord Hill's book on anti-fascism, which I really, really suggest. Gord Hill is a First Nations anarchist up in Canada, and he's written a lot about anti-colonialism, anti-fascism, much more straightforward sort of history things. So I would really, really suggest him. There is a Black Panther book that David Walker what's his name? Kwame. He's going to kill me for forgetting his last name. But there's the Black Panther book. I would suggest people reading that too. That's especially a bit of an easier entry in. I think it's more geared towards like younger readers or sort of all readers.
Marcus Kwame Anderson.
Right? Yeah, Marcus Kwame Anderson. Sorry, Margaret.
I gotta post the link to it.
Those are the two off the top of my head. To be totally honest, this is not a subject that breaks through very much.
Yeah,
there's a book called Big Black that's about the Attica uprising, and I would not specifically suggest reading that. I don't think it was written by people who were particularly interested in a clarity of voice, you know what I mean? But I think that's an example. Like, there was a period where there were these all white creative teams that did black books for a little bit because there was money for it, you know what I mean, after 2020. So I would be really, really careful, even though I'm gonna get sued for criticizing this book, but I would be really, really careful when trying to read on this topic and just double check the creative teams and see what their backgrounds are.
Sure.
We got another one here. This is over on Twitch. Eric MCI900 says, entertaining and educating in the comic format is pretty fantastic, but I am curious what kind of comics Ben reads and if he's done any big two work or has any big two character story that he would want to do.
What am I reading right now? I feel like probably like all cartoonists, when you're working on a graphic novel, you hate comics.
Yeah. So,
had a 5-year stint where I started to avoid comics I liked because I would start doubting what I was doing in my own book. And I'd be like, even I'd be reading a Capes book and I'd be like, should it be more like this?
And you're like, oh, no, I've been too deep.
So I've been reading Gord Hill again to get back into it. I've been reading this one manga series called Blue Box. It's like a romance comic that I'm really enjoying. I will say I'll read like Joe Sacco and other people that I think are like obvious, like, oh, Ben would read this. I do read that stuff. But I read a bunch of stuff that maybe people wouldn't like particularly expect me to read. Cool. Like Michael DeForge is probably my most favorite cartoonist of all time, and he's like an indie arts comic cartoonist.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. Cool. This book is great. It is fantastic. Given that this is 5 years of your work and it's finally out now, does that feel like a relief at all? Have you been able to look at it in stores, or per what we were just talking about, and you're like, get it out of my face for a little while, so then you'll come back to it later?
When the day of release, I definitely had a panic attack, for sure.
Really good.
I think there's always, when I turn a book in, I always think it's the ravings of a crazy person and deeply regret, you know. Even though I'll have people read it beforehand, I think as other people are reading it, I think that's like settled me more. But also I have a hobby. I do Muay Thai. So as soon as I turned the book in, I started training for my first amateur competition. So as the book was coming out, I was like in a ring fighting fighting another adult. I was
another
distracted.
Adult. Good.
Yeah.
Wow. Competition. You're out there getting in it. Wow.
I should mention you've done other things while you've been doing this book. Like, you have not been solidly working on this. You also won like an Eisner Award at the same time while you were in there for other work. How did you balance that? How did you balance spacing this out over 5 years while peppering other projects in the same in the way?
Oh, well, very poorly. it's just the reality of being, or at least as far as I know, of being a full-time freelance cartoonist. It's like you might sell a book, but you still gotta work. So I was still doing freelance things as I had done for years. My sort of output for a long time, maybe about 8 years, was stuff for like maybe the nib.com or like the New York Times would have me do like a page here and there, and I would put out maybe one short, very, maybe 60-page book maybe shorter, floppy, you know, a year. So I did sort of just have to maintain a workload. The drawing portion of the book took about 2.5 years. And about a year and a half in, I could only work on the book. I couldn't do other things because it was too much. I mean, people that read the book, there's these crowd scenes that I mentioned before. I couldn't cover them all with sound effects, and they were very exhausting.
And before we let you go, obviously, this is the big thing. This is out now. But are you taking a break? Are you moving on to the next thing? What's next for you?
Well, yeah, no breaks, obviously.
Ever.
I have a collection of some of the older work that I talked about, starting as old as 2017. So I have this collection of that stuff for Pantheon that'll come out next year.
Cool.
Other than that, I've been just doing little short form stuff on my Patreon, and you know, I'll be pitching another book around. We'll see on what. I mean, this book was a really big lesson to not go quite so big. 100 years of history was too many years.
That's a lot happened. 50 the next time.
Right, yeah.
Just do 1 year or like a couple months. Take a break.
50 seconds.
Yeah. 16 seconds. Do the research.
Right. This podcast. All right. Anyway, Ben, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations on the book.
Yes, congrats. It is fantastic. Love the book.
And, looking forward to such a great book. Next.
I appreciate it. Thanks, fellas.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks, man.
All right. There we go. The book, once again, is called Black Arms to Hold You Up. It is out now from Pantheon, and it is great.
Wow. Very
and
good.
Look at you guys holding up Black Arms to Hold You Up.
Yeah, we do TV.
And you do audience questions, my favorite part of the show, where you ask us questions, and what do? We answer them. What are you guys drinking tonight? We had a directive from our chef to drink some Oktoberfest beers.
Yeah.
I consumed too many of those over the weekend, so I moved on to something much more gentle, a gin and Campari with some grapefruit juice. Grandma's Kiss.
So gross.
Grandma's Kiss.
I just made that up. It's sour and bitter.
You've got to drop a Werther's Original at the bottom there.
There's already one in my mouth.
Nice.
Cool.
Nothing better than caramel and grapefruit juice. Pete, what are you drinking?
I got a car port, but I'm drinking garage beer.
Oh, man. Whenever Pete launches his brewery, it's a car port beer. I mean, this isn't a question, but I think Stanley's comment from a couple minutes ago, Pete should do martial arts.
Yeah, I've messed around with martial arts for many years.
Okay, now we're talking. What do you mean messed around? Well, let's hear about it.
In college,
your nunchucks don't count.
Okay. Well, in college, I did jiu-jitsu. Before that, I was doing a lot of karate. But then after college, I got into Tai Chi.
Really? And are you still doing any of the Tai Chi?
Yeah, I do. I do Tai Chi and stretching and stuff in the mornings.
Wow. Do you do, I'm sorry, in the morning? So do you go out like dawn and stand on a
long? Well, usually I get two trees that are close together, and I do a split as the sun comes up, and I'm just kind of in a pose.
Know, I hate AI, but I would love an image. That's the most tempted I've ever been to make an AI image, is Pete LePage doing a full morning split as the sun's coming up.
Who needs AI? You can go to wherever he lives and take a picture.
That's right. Yeah.
That's true. I guess I'll have to finally hunt him down. Haven't been invited yet.
you're always invited.
I'm not like Hamboom and Skiddly Doo, the guys you had over last weekend.
Skiddly Doo.
Oh, we have a great follow-up question here. Chris Samuelson would like to know, what part of Pennsylvania does Pete live in?
York, baby. York, PA. What's up? I just dropped the new. You know what I mean? I was living in New York City. I just dropped the new.
It makes sense. Old school. Pete got older and he moved to an older York.
That's right.
I was just in PA, Pete, and Jim Thorpe.
Oh.
Moving it over to you, Justin. Ken and Melissa LG would like to know, what type of cake did Justin eat or prefer for his birthday?
Great question. I'll answer both. I had a carrot cake, one of my faves.
Ooh, carrot but cake the fave, is awesome.
And this is a harder one to track down. It's a pineapple upside down cake.
Oh my God. What are you, SpongeBob? What the fuck?
Interesting. You're really pushing your grandma agenda today.
Well, I saw mommy kissing Santa Claus. I saw Pete kissing a grandma, and so it's on my mind.
What? Alex, your favorite cake on your birthday?
I do really like carrot cake as well. Also like a tiramisu. That's very good.
Oh, wow. I also enjoy a carrot cake, but I'm it's got to be the Carvel ice cream cake. You know what I mean?
Oh, which one?
It's the, well, any of them.
Just the regular one with the crunchies?
I need that you know, chocolate gravel.
You get a Fudgy the Whale, don't you?
I would love a Fudgy Whale. They don't always have
that. If
you
can, if you could swing it, you get a cookie opus.
Well, yeah, listen, you're asking Pete to choose a cake is like asking any of us to choose between our children. Pete loves all cakes and all cookies.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, Pete. Oh, I didn't get to finish telling you the story. So Pete and I were hanging out this weekend in Baltimore.
Yes. Yeah.
On the way back, I stopped at the Biden Welcome Center on the border between Maryland and New Jersey. Highly recommend. Very nice rest stop. Very big.
Joe's there.
Yeah, Joe's there always. They can't get him out. He keeps just wandering around in a circle.
He loves it.
But maybe this is a lot of places. I had never seen it before. They have, you guys know the Cake Boss. You're familiar with him. They had a Cake Boss cake slice vending machine. This is not a joke. Like full gigantic.
What cake slice did you get?
Hold on. None.
What? So mad.
What? You mean none? You went to and saw a Cake Boss and you didn't get
this
no slices of cake?
My point is what the Cake Boss cake vending machine, which is already a crazy thing to see.
How are you going to tell a story and it doesn't end with you getting fucking anything from this vending machine? You just looked at it.
He tipped over the vending machine. The Cake Boss was just standing there behind
him. Well, that's what I was going to say is that there's a video screen on it that mostly is showing them frosting cakes. But whenever you walk by it, and I tested this several times because I was like, this could not be happening. When you walk by it, it switches to a video of the Cake Boss being like, hey, come on, have a slice of cake over here. What are you doing? And just yelling at
you. So
you
listened.
No!
So you listened and got a slice of cake.
I'll tell you what, I might have bought a slice of cake from the cake vending machine until Cake Boss started yelling at me.
Yeah, hey, yo, I did not want to be yelled at.
He's like, stop playing my emotions. Stop walking by. I've been buying slices already.
You got a long drive ahead of you. What's better than a big slice of cake in your tummy?
Come on. I can't believe you didn't get a cake.
I believe it.
That's ridiculous. I believe it. I find the
Let me tell you this cool story about a vending machine. I didn't use it. I just walked by it. Cool, though.
Why do you like cake management so much when you should
also,
be
also, why is the cool part buying something from a vending
because machine? You participated in what was happening. You went to a place, you saw this thing, and you just fucking walked by it and walked away.
I'll bet. great. I don't know what that was, but
that was a rant. That was Pete's the Cake Boss boss, and so he has to yell about it.
Great. Stanley asks, what are the advantages of larger cons like New York versus smaller cons like Baltimore? Great question. What do you guys think?
Well, Alex, you experienced both.
I did.
Just this year.
In too close proximity.
Yes.
And Alex, you got to hang out with Justin in New York and then me in Baltimore. Did you have more fun at one or the other?
That's a great question. That's a really
daddy question.
Well, one of you just yelled at me for not using a vending machine. Which one of you was that? I just can't see.
I don't see how that's relevant. We're talking about two separate times here.
I guess so. They're, as you'd imagine, like very different, but also every con is different, which is a bad answer. But like, I was talking to a lot of people at Baltimore who were wondering about New York because they knew it happened the weekend before. And New York, we've talked about this before, like it's grown so that Artist Alley is almost the size of a con in and of itself, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Just if that's what you're into, which of course that's what we are into. But the main con floor is San Diego style, loud, booming. There's things going on everywhere.
Big room.
There was Post Malone's big rig, like a literal big rig was on
sick,
the floor.
Bro.
Was it? But,
dude, drink some
Bud
Light, hang out with Post Malone. Come on.
Post Malone was inside the big rig the entire time and then popped out to scare people.
Just kept yanking on the horn. That guy's out. Like,
every time he passed by, you could do like the little chuggy chug thing.
Dude,
so it's huge. It's like overwhelming. And you are exhausted for the first 10 minutes of going in there because there's just too many things going on. But it's also thrilling, exciting. There were big announcements, big things going on, big stars everywhere. Something like Baltimore, I really like because it's much more focused on the comics and the artists, and there was a Hollywood presence, like, but it was literally like versus, you know, this huge thousands of seats venue. We were at the booth, like Giancarlo Esposito just kind of like idly walked by, or Carl Lubley was walking by and sipping a coffee on the first day. It's that sort of thing where it's just, it's a little more pleasant and down to earth. And I like that because it lets you meet and hang out with people. But why are we taking away
Pete
this
quick? Pete and I just did the same thing where we want to see this image that Eric MCI made, but we can't do it
I'll bring it up. Answer this question.
I'll answer the question. Let me take it. So I like bigger cons because there's more to see, more to do. You'll find a kind of more interesting booth that you probably wouldn't on a smaller con. What I like about a smaller con is less lines, more chance to talk with people, more people to kind of see, and it's not as crazy, so it's a little bit chiller. So yeah, it's less chaotic, but you don't have as much variety. There isn't all the kind of things. So, but I love them both. I definitely love going to a big con. I love going to a small con.
The variety is lovely.
Yeah, yeah. And I have like staples that I got to do every time I go to a con. So it's
What are those? Carry knives in, obviously.
No, that's you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that. You should. You know, it's one of those things where you can't forget where you're going, and then you get off a subway or a train ride, and then be like, oh crap.
Yeah.
What am I walking into?
My knife bag.
I should have brought my knife bag.
I almost walked into the Met Museum with my backpack that had a prop gun in it that was too real. And I literally set my bag down on a thing. It was like with some relatives. And I was like, oh, I have to leave now. I have to leave immediately before I am dragged to sketch comedy jail.
I once, we didn't realize we had packed a prop gun in our luggage going into the airport. And that was a big problem.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, you got caught.
We got caught. Yeah. Yeah. We got caught. They took it. We explained. We were like, there's a red nib on it. It's a fake gun. It's not real.
I am a sketch comedian. I think these things are funny.
We were just like babbling for probably 15 minutes at them. And then they ended up confiscating the gun. But that was it. And then we shot him with our real gun. I can't open this link. I don't know what it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not opening correct.
I didn't.
Can we read this for our audio podcast?
Sure.
Is that okay? Stanley is wondering if Pete punched Alex over the weekend.
Oh, great question. I didn't.
If I was thinking about it, I should have, because I owe him for a couple, but, you know, but I was having thing, too Pete, busy. I was so happy to see you that I forgot about all that.
I was
going to
say, you had too packed of a schedule, because you got there, you had to wander the con floor, buy a t-shirt, then wander the con floor, buy another t-shirt, then you took a very nice long lunch at the pub across the street. And then
Did you?
I'm sorry. Am I on some kind of clock with you? Is there something I should have been doing?
No, you had a great time.
I was walking around.
How could you possibly have had time to punch me when you were over at the pub enjoying a nice chicken sandwich?
Yeah, I was. I had a lovely chicken sandwich and had some. I was surrounded by all these sports figures, and because I was rocking all my nerd gear, everybody wanted to talk to me about comic books. I felt very popular and seen, so it was fun.
Sports figures.
Yes. I am being glib because Pete and I did some interviews over the weekend. I also did some interviews solo. They're all rolling out in the Comic Book Club feed. Very fun chats. We had a great time catching up with Cliff Chiang together, which was lovely. We also talked to, oh my God, who did we talk to in the morning?
Tony Fleece?
Tony Fleece.
Yes, Tony Fleece I chatted with. He came over after we left, Pete. I'm sorry.
Philip Kennedy Johnson was
there. We go. That's who we had. Great seeing him as well. But
he wanted to hang out with us. It was so cool. Like, he was like, hey, what are you guys doing later?
And here's I think he wanted to hang out with you because as soon as he heard you were going, he wasn't interested. But we'll see.
I got to see how this Pete guy ticks. Let's go to a bar.
But there was an even bigger meeting. There was a bigger meetup at Baltimore Comic Con. Derek Mainhart says, what was the story behind Pete and the banana people?
So I saw this group of banana people and I was like, oh, I got to get a picture with them. And what was so funny was...
By banana people, you mean people in banana costumes.
That's right. People dressed up as bananas. And so I was like, hey, can I get a picture with you guys? And they're like, sure. Why? And I was like, oh, I always say super tight bananas. And they were like, what? And I was like, yeah, when something's great, I say it's super tight bananas or super tight nanners. And that what was funny was the people came up and were asking the banana guys, like, hey, what's going on? Why are people, like, taking pictures? And they're like, this guy says super tight nanners. And then, it, like, I heard him, like, passing it on. I was like, oh, man, this is great.
Like a mind plague. You infected
like, maybe
people.
Catch on. This guy loves super tight nanners. So, well, yeah, it was so fun.
I think,
did you get in super tight with those nanners?
They were very nice and super
here, this
happy.
This may come up immediately.
Super tight bananas.
A video.
Here, I'll play it again.
Super tight bananas.
There we go.
Exactly.
They really stroke their nubs.
Yeah. You know, they're bananas.
Yeah.
They're going to remember that piece.
Yes. And Stanley, while we're still talking about Baltimore, says, Torin sounded very cool. I chatted with Torin Grunbeck on...
I love talking to Torin.
Great, great chat. She is awesome. Really fascinating. I will call out two things in particular that were really surprising to me that you can hear her talk more at length about. One is she talked about the Nightmare Before Christmas book that she's doing for Dynamite and was pretty honest about the difficulties of working with Disney on the book, because they are so restrictive about how far you can go outside the continuity of the movie, which is to say not at all. Like she called out one of the things that she mentioned was she thought, oh, a town like Halloween Town would have a little apothecary in it. So they'll go to the apothecary. And they're like, no, that's not in the movie. You can't do that. And it's kind of so crazy. Weird. So definitely listen to that. The other thing that was surprising that maybe you guys have heard before, but I have never heard before in my life. So she's written Venom stuff and Carter stuff. She's now writing Spider-Girl. She also writes Catwoman for DC and other things. And she was mentioning one of the big differences for her between Marvel and DC is that Marvel, particularly for spider characters, is like, you got to end with a splash page hero shot. Like
really?
Specific, and in fact, she said that they demand, I don't know if the word she used was demand.
I don't think it was
but
demand.
No, it might have been, that in every issue you have to have at least one page, a big page of Spider-Man or a spider character doing cool Spider-Man stuff. And it was the same thing in Carnage and Venom, that whatever you're doing Carnage and Venom, they always have to be doing one big splash page of goopy symbiote stuff, and you have to include that.
I mean, that certainly tracks. I couldn't can't think of a book that doesn't have that.
Yeah, but that was surprising. She was saying versus DC that it makes it a little more challenging, but you could actually end a book with something that is not just like, and Catwoman swinging at the paddle. Instead, you can do something a little more subtle, which is trickier, but allows you more latitude, potentially. So that's all. Just very surprised. You could hear me on the podcast being like, what are you talking about? But there you go. Lots of good chats over the weekend that are rolling out.
Yes, the other thing I just wanted to, I went over to the Mouse Guard table. I always have to do that at a con, and saw my guy David Peterson there.
Davey P.
Yeah, it's he's still plugging away, which gives me hope every time I see him, man. That guy does fantastic work. And
you must know by now that he's just 100 mice in a skin suit.
How dare you? That's never been proven.
That's... You can see the little tails and the shifty eyeballs.
The mouse guard is his skin. It's guarding everybody from the mice.
And
how are you going to write? How are you going to make a book?
I wonder when I ask people, hey, do you want to come over and do an interview? And they're like, well, I'm kind of busy. This is why. This is why.
There's no way you could know that much about mice. You can't know that much about mice unless you've lived as a mouse.
It's true. It's true, Pete. You can't deny
it. It's not true. It's not about mice. It's a story. It's a very human story that just happens to star mice.
You can fight me on a lot of things, but to say that Mouse Guard isn't about mice, sir, no. I have to make
more,
a stand.
It's more about the guard than the mice, really.
It's right, a human story that features mice, is what you said? That's
right.
Fucked up. I'll tell you what, Pete. That's a bad take. That's fine. We finally got him. Bad take.
Okay, why don't we move on with our next section, which is trivia. For that, I'm going to turn it over to the King of Bad Takes, Super Tight Donners himself, Pete and Paige.
All right. This is the part we give back to you, the lovely audience. We do appreciate you listening and supporting us. It's very nice of you. Yeah, it's trivia. It's a chance to win $25 free from Midtown Comics Online. Because if you had $25, you should go to a comic book shop. I mean, come on.
Come on.
Oh, so all we need is a brave volunteer, a first stand up, a pick me, a hey, I'll do it, and you'll win $25 free.
No bravery necessary.
To Midtown Comics Online.
Anybody.
A mouse car is actually a piece of sports equipment, says Derek Mainhart. Yes, technically. For if you have like a very,
a
micro penis.
Oh, man. I was really hoping you guys weren't going to make that joke.
I was talking hoping about mice.
Yeah, me too, in a way.
Yeah.
It's a human story about a maestro penis.
David Quinley says me.
Yeah, thank you, David Quinley. Thank you for saving us. Really saved the show there, David. We appreciate that. Okay, today's trivia is about the comic, News from the Fallout, and a small nod to the legend, Jane Goodall. R.I.P., thanks for all the good you did. Please listen to all three options for making your selection. Here we go. Question number one. Who writes this amazing comic from Image? Is it A, Chris Condon? B, quit your bitching. At least your last name isn't Leto. C, Jared Lipworth.
Thanks for all the good you did. You did all the good. Really?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's right there in the
Lars
name.
Lars says Jane Greedall.
Hey, come on, Lars. Good for you, Lars. Thanks
what was your favorite thing that Jane did, Pete, would you say?
I would say it was all the apes? They're chimpanzees. But yeah, okay. I would say it was all her work that she dedicated.
She didn't talk to one ape?
I mean, as a zoologist, I mean, that's a struggle, bro.
Are you telling me she didn't talk to one ape?
Am I remembering this wrong? She was taken up the Empire State Building by a giant ape, right?
I think that's right. That's where she first started talking to them.
Yeah. She was like, this seems interesting.
A is correct. Nice guess.
I wish I could talk more to this King Kong because he's potentially going to drop me from this giant building.
Question number two. Who is the incredible artist on this comic? Is it A, Jeffrey Allen Love? B, I don't know, T, but if you listen to your last name, you should be a priest or someone who loves pastures. C, Tim Pastor.
Nice, right over the plate. Was it her gentle touch, Pete, do you think? Or is it... why was she so good with the chimps?
I do think it was her patience and her stillness that helped.
Her stillness. Yeah. Wow. And how's her obituary going?
It's tough, man. It's a lot to cover. I mean,
you got to release it. It's been a while.
You should get that out there.
Is it A?
A is correct. It's right. Don't overthink these. Here we go. Last one. Question number three. This book is about what going horribly wrong in 1962. Is it A, nuclear bomb test? B, yo, BB, wipe that smirk and stop trying to twerk. C, Brian Burke.
Wow. Yeah. No rhyme or reason, except for some rhyme on that last one.
Very little reason, though.
Now, Jane Goodall did teach chips to twerk, is what you're saying, right?
That's not, don't.
I believe so.
Don't, that's
don't,
that
pull, don't pull legacy. That from what's going on.
Pete, what did you, you must finally know that Jane Goodall was just two chimps in a skin suit. Though.
Oh, how dare you. Do not turn this against
so as she could talk so well to them, she was one of them.
You can't prove that.
Huh? A
is correct, yes.
Amazing. Congratulations, correct. David. You are going to get a gift card to Midtown Comics. Shoot us an email and we will get that to you. And Pete, what secret Jane Goodall movie are you referencing?
Of course, we're talking about the 2017 movie Jane.
Oh, wow. What a nice way to bring your topics together. Yeah. And folks, please subscribe to Pete's Substack of just homemade obituaries called Nanners Go Down. It's about going down is about people dying.
Yeah.
Just to be clear. Of course. And I think there's been a lot of misunderstanding in the audience what Nanners Go Down is about. But it's about casual obituaries.
Tomorrow, new comic books come out. Oh, what are you guys looking forward to, Pete?
So many great stuff.
What's on your pull list?
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? Yeah, I think so. Thank you, Jason Aaron. Also, news from the Fallout number 5. I mean, the art. Come on, the art. And then, speaking of the art, absolute Wonder Woman. You want to talk about super tight manners? Come on. Even Justin's dog's getting hyped for that book.
Yeah, definitely likes. That's the tightest nanner of them all, is having a dog that barks every couple of minutes.
Yeah.
What am I looking forward to? You might ask.
That's what we're wondering.
Sure. We've done this a couple of times. I didn't think you'd even.
You transition a little sure. bit. I am Alex with a little.
I am Alex.
You spent so much time worrying about your intro. You've been missing out on some transitional elements. I'm just kidding. I'm looking forward to. I mean, I don't know exactly what this book is about, but Thanksgiving number one that Mark Russell's doing is very intriguing to me. So timely, and then I. You know, we've talked a lot about this X-Men event going through the Revelation, the Age of Revelation. Radioactive Spider-Man number one from Joe Kelly is very interesting to me because it doesn't seem like a fit, but maybe it will be.
A couple of ones I'm going to throw out. Looking forward to Justin's barking dog, as always. Yeah,
come on.
Second of all, I will say Tony Fleece, really, after chatting with him, really sold me on Omega Kids number one. We chatted about that a bit. And that is up at the podcast feed now. That's another Age of Revelation thing.
Did you talk with them at Baltimore or New York?
At Baltimore, yeah. I said this earlier in the show. You just missed him. You left, and then he came over to the table, and we
in a banana costume.
Like half an hour, and he was like, "Thank God."
He was like, "Oh, this is perfect. I've been waiting for Pete to leave so I could come over and say what's up."
He was actually, did you see him? He was like huddled behind a garbage can the entire time you were there.
And no, I didn't see him.
Came right over. And then what was the other thing? Exquisite Corpses number 6. That's been going pretty well. So curious to see what happens with that. All of those books and many more books are going to be in our Stack podcast that comes out Wednesday, 9 a.m., both the Stack feed and the Comic Book Club feed. And folks, that is it for this week's show. A couple of people want to thank Peglo for coming on to talk about To the Stars and Back. Volume 1 is out now from Little Brand Inc. Also, Ben Passmore for talking about Black Arts to Hold You Up, on sale now from Pantheon. So cool. Next week on the show, Matt Wagner and Kelly Jones are going to be back to talk about Dracula, Book 3, The Count. And Nandor Schaefer is also going to be back to talk about Seasons. Comic Book Club News, our daily news show, Monday through Friday. Let's Hear It for the Boys, our boys podcast recapping Gen V, including the finale this week. Patreon.com/Comic Book Club to support this show and all the shows we do. You can subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, or the app of your choice. Comic Book Club on Blue Sky, ComicBookClubLive.com. For this podcast and many more, until next time, I am Alex.
I, Justin. Good night.
Take care of yourself. We need you.